Alistair McGrath, in his little book, The Mystery of the Cross, says that when he was a child, he learned to count by using an abacus. But once he learned the basics, the rules of addition and subtraction and multiplication and division and so forth, he set the abacus aside as useful, but now totally unnecessary as a learning aid. There's no need for it. And drawing on that experience, he comments that some people treat the cross and resurrection of Jesus much like that abacus. Just a theological learning aid, and then we move beyond these things. We become increasingly sophisticated. We maybe even set them aside because we've gone on to some other expression of spirituality, something that we think is more than sufficient. Well, hopefully you know that nothing could be further from the truth. The cross and resurrection of Jesus form the foundation of what we believe as Christians and who we are. They can't be replaced. They can never be superseded. Without these, we have nothing. And I think it's fair to say we are nothing. We just continue to spiral into dissolution. Therefore, this Maundy Thursday, in preparation for communion, I'd like us to look again at the cross of Christ, but this time from the perspective of the writer to the book of Hebrews, and that perspective found in Hebrews chapter 13, verses 12 through 14. I'll give you a moment to turn there. Hebrews 13, verses 12 through 14. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Hence, let us go out to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. For here we do not have a lasting city, but we're seeking the city which is to come. Now, one of the purposes of the book of Hebrews is to convince us that Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament priesthood. The priesthood, with all of its functions, foreshadows the greater lasting priesthood of Jesus. And in these last days, God has spoken to us through his Son, through the definitive final sacrifice and the message of Jesus. And that being true, these verses shed some light on the cross and reveal as well what our ongoing response to it should be. So let's come at this particular text by way of two questions. The first, to what is Christ committed? And you'll notice verse 12 begins with that little word, therefore, showing us the connection with the preceding verses. So if you look at verses 10 and 11, we're told that we have an altar, and he's referring to the cross. We have an altar from which those who serve the tabernacle, meaning the priests, the earthly priests, have no right to eat. For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy place by the high priest as an offering for sin are burned outside the camp. And what the writer's doing is he's simply telling them about their practices and their history and their theological understanding. The writer is reiterating the point that on the Day of Atonement, certain procedures were painstakingly followed. On that day, the blood of the prescribed slain animals for sin offerings was brought by the high priest into the Holy of Holies. And on that day, the priest did not have permission to eat the slaughtered animals, but instead those carcasses were carried outside the camp. Now, outside the camp means outside originally where the tabernacle was, and that then, of course, with the building of the temple and the second temple outside of Jerusalem, carried outside and completely burned. And that was done in accordance with Leviticus 16:27. The bull of sin offering and the goat of the sin offering whose blood was brought in to make atonement in the holy place shall be taken outside the camp, and they shall burn their hides, their flesh, and their refuse in the fire. So crucial to this idea, or to this text, is the idea that the camp where the temple is considered holy ground. But outside the camp, outside the city, where the animals are burned, that's deemed unholy ground. It's unclean. So that's where you put the bodies that are bearing the sin. You take them outside. They can't be tolerated inside where it's holy. They become sin. So God's people had been made holy, purified by the blood of the atonement. And because the encampment or the city of God's people was to be holy, these sin-laden bodies had to be distanced from the people. These bodies became identified with the sin of the people. And again, that's why they were burned outside the camp. And the person burning the carcasses had to purify himself before he could come back inside the gate into the camp. Now, with that backdrop in view, when you come to verse 12, the writer makes an astonishing, startling application of all this to Jesus. Now, notice what he says. Therefore, in light of verse 11, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood, suffered outside the gate, or verse 13, the camp. Now, in addition to the idea of a suffering Messiah, this is extraordinary, and it's shocking for four reasons. First, by dying outside the gate, Jesus' death signifies the death of the Jewish sacrificial system. With his death, it's finished. The temple, the priesthood, the sacrifices, the ceremonies, no longer needed. No longer are they considered hallowed. They are unhallowed even. As Hebrews 10:14 says, we've been sanctified through the sin offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. It doesn't need to be repeated. Now, second, tied into this and getting closer to the point here, is that Jesus did not suffer inside the camp where all those previous sacrifices were slaughtered. Again, he suffered outside the camp. This means then that the location of the cross is actually in our place, meaning our location. It's in the place of our defilement. Jesus didn't suffer and die in a holy place. He did not do his work in the tabernacle, in the temple, in the Holy of Holies. Jesus' death is expulsion from the sacred precincts of the temple. He suffered and died in the unholy place. He died for us in the wilderness of our sin. Now, we're so at home in the wilderness of our sin, we don't think of it as wilderness. We think of it as a comfortable place, a known place, the right place, but it's actually the wrong place. And Jesus' death on Golgotha corresponds to the removal of bodies outside the gate. It's not just that he died outside the gate where executions took place, although that's true. The point that the writer is pressing home is that Jesus fulfilled the Levitical requirement that the carcass of the animal sacrificed on the Day of Atonement be taken outside the camp. Third, the execution outside the gate reveals the shame of being excluded from the temple precincts. It's hard for us to get our minds around that, but it's powerful and dramatic. If you're living then and there, to be excluded from the temple precincts means to be cut off from the community. Think back to chapter 12, verse 2, where we're urged to run the race set before us. You know, how do we do that? We fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising its shame. It's the shame, yes, of being erroneously labeled a criminal, but even more so, the shame of being expelled from the sacred temple of God, being expelled from the people of God, being emphatically labeled a blasphemer of God, which is the charge that they put on him to send him to the cross, right? And so he's an outcast in all ways. And it's as an outcast in all ways that Jesus gives himself up as a sacrifice. His death seals the fact that his rejection is final. And then fourth, by suffering outside the gate, Jesus shows us that he totally identifies with the people of the world and the plight of our wilderness. On our own, in our sin, we're unable to draw near to God, but God draws near to us. In the incarnation of Jesus and ultimately in the execution of Jesus, he comes to our unholy ground to bring us holiness, to atone for sin on the cross. And so, he dies outside the gate so that we can come inside the veil, which is tomorrow's message. And even as the sacrificed animals were identified with the sin of the people, even more so, Jesus identifies with our sin. He becomes one of us, dies in our place as our substitution, in our place in that way, and in our place, meaning in our unholy world. Or as Paul put it in the message we heard some weeks back, 2 Corinthians 5:21, God made him, Christ, who knew no sin, to be sin on our behalf, that we might become the righteousness of God in him, meaning Christ. And so Christ's purpose as verse 12 makes explicit, is to sanctify his people. That means just to make us holy, to make us righteous. And the means by which this is accomplished is his shed blood. And Jesus, out of his love for his people, spares nothing, avoids nothing, instead gives everything, even his own blood, for our sanctification so that we can be in the presence of God and not be consumed. And the all-significant place in which this is accomplished is the unholy territory of the world in which we live, outside the gate. And that's the commitment that Jesus makes to and for his people's holiness. He came to us, for that. Now look at verses 13 and 14. That's what he's committed to. The question then becomes, to what are we committed? And the answer is, we should be committed to identifying with Jesus. Listen again to how this happens. Hence, in light of what Jesus did for us, let us go out to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. Why? For here we don't have a lasting city, but we're seeking the city which is to come. This signifies what our response to the death of Jesus outside the camp should be. Verse 13 can't make it any clearer. We're to go outside the camp. Go out to him. We bear his reproach. So just as Jesus suffered outside the gate, we make a commitment to go outside the gate also, to take the message of the cross and Jesus' redemption to the world. So we're saying, when we go out to any place with the gospel, we're saying we acknowledge one thing: Jesus has already been there, in one sense. He's outside the gate. So when we go someplace that's uncomfortable to share the good news of the gospel, we're going forth with the very same reproach, maybe to lesser degree, of course, unless you give your life up, but you're going with the same reproach that Jesus had to bear. So our whole lives, we should think of them as going with Jesus outside the camp to bear reproach. We're not given polar opposite options. That is to say, we're not given the option of total avoidance or total assimilation. Those are two options that the people of God are never given. Let us go out to him outside the camp bearing his reproach. In other words, we're called to follow Jesus, to go out to where he went, to the outside places, to the unholy places. Now just pause for a moment. Where are those outside places that you're passing by every day? Where are those unholy places that you're aware of, that you skirt around? Because to identify with Christ and his gospel means that we're willing to bear his reproach. We don't mind if the scandal of his cross is reflected back on us, because it's actually an honor. And when we go outside the gate and we engage with the reproach of Jesus, perhaps by washing the feet of the world, so to speak, serving them, because that's what it's all about, right? The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. When we take that model as our pattern and bear the reproach and the stigma, when we do that, nonetheless, we're washing feet. We are displaying Jesus. Even if his reproach becomes ours, even if the insults heaped on him are heaped on us, even if his sufferings become our sufferings, it's worth it, because we're following him by going outside to the defiled, unholy world with the holy message of the gospel. Now, to do that, we need motivation. And that's where verse 14 comes in. What is sufficient motivation to bear the reproach of Jesus? What does the writer say? Well, our motivation is tied to our focus, right? And our focus can't be on the world of reproach, but it has to be on the fullness of redemption. So, the writer says, for here we don't have a lasting city, but we're seeking the city which is to come. This is a repetitive theme in the book of Hebrews, chapter 10, chapter 11, chapter 12. Our faith has a future orientation. We don't live forever in a state of impermanence or in the condition of the wilderness. Something real and lasting and rewarding and true awaits us. Think about it this way. Impermanence is burned deeply into the Jewish consciousness. Sometimes moving from place to place was voluntary, but quite often in the history of the Jewish people, it wasn't, and it isn't voluntary. To exist as a Jew is to be displaced. And because of this, in the Bible, the desert and the wilderness are symbolic of the nature of the Jewish life and faith. For centuries, millennia, the land of Israel was actually but a temporary haven. From the Babylonian exile onwards, even down to the modern age, a large part of the Jewish people have been homeless. They've traveled throughout the world, unable to find a place to settle. And even when they do settle, very often they're uprooted. Just a couple of weeks ago, Elizabeth and I went to the MFA, and one of the exhibits we saw was a series of photographs that were taken by a Jewish man who was designated the official photographer of the ghetto of Lodz in Poland. So the Nazis designated this man to take pictures of Jews doing work for the Nazis so that they would look happy. But what he also did is he took pictures of them in real life. Of course, they weren't happy. Confined in this ghetto, not allowed to leave. The ghetto was actually deemed to be unholy, and the land outside, a street bisected this ghetto. They weren't even allowed to touch the street. If they did, they were executed. The street was holy. They were unholy. And this man took pictures of all stages and all aspects of life in this increasingly terrible ghetto, and as they were shipped off to the concentration camps. He took these pictures secretly, and then he buried them in a steel canister in a field, or not much of a field, it's in the ghetto, but in a plot of land. And then when the Russians liberated, he went and he dug up this canister. And these photographs then were ultimately later developed when he emigrated to Canada. And this is the first time they've been on display here in the U.S. Uprooted again and again. Little wonder then, as one rabbi says, the theme of exile dominates and preoccupies the Jews. And so Jews who were vintners and farmers all over the world prayed for rain, not just when their crops and their land needed rain, but when the hills of Jerusalem required rain. Even the cycles of the year, the prayers and the holidays were all observed according to the climate and the calendar of Israel. So they're like travelers who keep their watches set on the time at home, right? They always keep in mind real time. So it is that the Jewish people kept their spiritual clock set to the time at home, as into the rhythms of life in Israel. They did this to fortify their souls, to reinforce their sense of dislocation on their way to ultimate location. And thus, in a very poignant custom, traditional Jewish homes leave a corner of the house unpainted to indicate that this particular dwelling is temporary, just a stop on the way home. In and of itself, it's not home. It's unfinished. Now, with that thought, go back to Hebrews 13. Hebrews 13, 12 through 14, teaches the end of impermanence, the end of spiritual homelessness and exile from God, and of course, the way to our true home. Because Jesus has come, and he's painted the corner of the house red with his atoning blood, so that we might permanently come to God through him and find real holiness and our true home in him and in his presence, and ultimately the lasting city to come. Jesus died outside the gate so that we can, in fact, come home. Dear Lord, you were death in an unholy place for unholy people. Your death to sanctify us, to make us righteous. Your death to wash away the outward and inner manifestations of sin in our lives. Your death that we might belong to you and find in you our home. And having found our home in you, help us to go outside the camp, through the gates to this world, and not hide in assimilation or accommodation or avoidance, but rather to be willing to bear the reproach of Jesus if need be, to take up that gospel and fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who endured the cross and despised its shame. Help us to take Jesus not only as the author of our faith and the object of our faith, but the model of our faith. We do this night as we think about the Lord's table, as we think about what it means and where it sends us. Renew in our lives a commitment to go outside the gate and proclaim the name of Jesus. In his name we pray. Amen. Please stand as we sing.